what I would encourage people to do is actually also listen.
Yes.
You know, because when you're thinking of the next thing you want to say in response, you're not listening. And we all have valuable opinions.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean we have to agree. It doesn't mean we have to hate each other.
Sherlock here for Franklin Matters, Franklin Public Radio. Anywhere on the internet, WFPR.FM, and in the local Franklin, Mass. FM radio dial 102.9. Here today in the studio with Donna Grady. Thank you, Donna, for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
And for people who may not, well, Donna Grady, isn't she the FEAS, the Franklin Education President?
I am. I am the FEA President at this time. I've been FEA President for about 8 years now, and I am a kindergarten teacher at Keller. I've been there since it opened, and I was in Jefferson before then.
So you've got quite a bit of experience on the teaching side and then on kind of the negotiation side, leading the union, which is all, or at least most of, if not the educators in Franklin.
That's true. Actually, the FEA is a wall-to-wall union, so we represent pretty much everybody except for custodians who went to DPW.
That many years ago, that
many
transition.
Years ago, yes.
Right, there was a separate other piece. We don't have to go there and do that. That's fine, yes. And as a bargaining unit, clearly your focus, other than teaching the children, which is the number one piece, is certainly looking for, you know, compensation and being taken care of in order to do what you need to do.
Compensation is a piece of it. Honestly, we look for the best working conditions for all of our educators. And when I say educators, I don't specify, because everybody who comes in contact with our kids are educators, be they bus drivers, van drivers, cafeteria, ESPs, secretaries, nurses. I know I'm leaving somebody out. LPNs. Everybody who works in our schools are educators for the kids. And that's who the FEA represents. And so when we have better working conditions, it is much better learning conditions for the kids. Is compensation a part of it? Absolutely.
Well, it's always a piece of it.
Absolutely.
It's not necessarily the biggest piece, because clearly, as much as you are getting compensated, you're still doing it for the love of the kids.
Yes, it's true.
And by disclosure, my wife spent 20 years in kindergarten as well in Franklin School, so I've got a little bit of experience being exposed to that as well.
A little bit. I was very lucky to be able to work with your wife, so very enjoyable.
So the working conditions, let's start there.
Sure.
So it's not just from the bell to the bell. Clearly, that's a key piece. That's mm-hmm. the delivery focal time.
Yes.
Because that's your face time with the kids.
Yes. So the delivery is bell to bell. And so the preschool has their own time. All elementary has just about the same time, middle school and high school. And what goes on during the day really belongs to Franklin. We also have after school responsibilities as well, be them staff meetings. We do have, at least at the elementary level, we have meetings during the day.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, 99% of them relate to the kids, whether they're special education meetings, whether they're consults with each other to talk about children and what they may need. We meet with parents during the day when we're not with the kids. It's really obviously student-centered. At the end of the day, we do, as I said, have faculty and staff meetings or department meetings. Many of us stay to do our report cards or our what I call the business side, that often takes hours. A lot of us stay to consult at a grade level and talk about what we're doing for the next week or the next month or whatever. A lot of us are reviewing all the new curriculum that comes in. Our specialists, people who do at the elementary level, PE, music, math, art, library, STEM, and other things. Again, I know I'm forgetting somebody. They prepare the kids' work, which are a lot more project-based, for example. And we have, I know that Night of the Arts is coming up for many of the elementary schools.
Right, right.
So that entails, I know there's some PE, there's art projects that go up that are gorgeous. There's music presentations.
Mm-hmm.
So we're always working on something. We are not educators are not a body who sits still very often.
No, and anybody who has visited the schools, it's kind of hard to find you in one place because you are continually moving.
Correct. We don't, you know, we do have chairs in our rooms, but we are not there very often.
So, humorous aside, a used school chair, teacher chair, might be a good bargain because it's not really as used, even though it might have been there for some number of years.
Yes.
Yeah, and having been and visited in a few classrooms, I can attest to that as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Planning time is another piece that, from what I understand, it certainly has been a piece of negotiation.
Yes.
Because while you've got from clock time, hours start, hours end, you also need some planning time that's, quote, compensated for within the school hours.
Correct.
As opposed to, as you mentioned before, just taking it home, which I know a number of do because it's just more like it's part of the job. It needs to get done.
Right. And our job during the day is to be with the kids. And so we can't plan things for the kids while we're with the kids. It just doesn't work.
No.
We can't split ourselves. You know, we don't really ever have enough help. We could have 10 people in a classroom and it's still not really enough. The planning periods that we have, so the last negotiations, for example, we went from 35 minutes to 40 minutes. And people say, okay, well, that's 5 to 10 minutes. But the reality is at least on the elementary side, that time is walking your class to wherever they're going, picking them up, and you want to get them back in a timely way.
Mm-hmm.
It's making sure you have all your materials for whatever you need. And usually you're preparing for the next activity. You may be setting up the room, but you're preparing for something that may be happening 4 days, 5 days later. You usually try to use the restroom. You're responding to emails, making phone calls, making sure that if you have copying for the team that that's done. So out of the 40 minutes, I would say we actually sit, for about 15, maybe 10. So, you know, it's not, nobody's sitting twiddling their thumbs. A lot of times, because there's no other time during the day, we are consulting with our colleagues. If we have students who have IEPs or 504s or special needs, are we doing the right thing for every student? Are we following those IEPs and 504s? And when that happens, so then I give my time for that. So then that day I may not have a prep. I do a consult instead. Because
mm-hmm.
the other way to do it is either before school or after school.
Right.
And that's the only time. But I still have my own children to get off to school or to pick up.
Right. There's enough other things going on.
Yes.
And then if the student's still not on that IAP, ed plan,
yep.
et cetera, there's that other MT... multi-tiers support process where
MTSS, yes.
Some people start getting identified, and there's still collaboration, coordination in order to, this is what we're seeing, is this right? Do we need more? How else do we further define? And then how else do we provide the mitigations and our recovery and our extra steps, et cetera?
Exactly. So, for example, in a little one, a kindergartner, usually a math and a literacy specialist are involved. We have Title I interventionists who we are so blessed to have. We may have other interventionists as well. And so when we do these various assessments, some are on Chromebooks. The assessments we used to do, as your wife knows, used to take a minimum of an hour and a half per child. We're not going to have them sit and do that for an hour and a half. So it goes over an extended time. And they're usually one-on-one interview style. Then we sit with the team who's done other assessments, and we see is what came up in the assessment. Does it match what I see as the classroom teacher? We always like to involve the ESPs because we can't do what we do without the ESPs. They are the people who are really directly supporting the kids, perhaps while the teacher, myself, are facilitating.
Mm-hmm. And just for the acronym sake.
Sure, yes, sorry.
I know that schools are full of acronyms, and I try to make sure people understand them as well. So educational support professionals.
Yes.
Generally, they're special ed trained. But they not necessarily always?
So not necessarily always. And a lot of people know ESPs as paras, classroom aides. I call them teachers. They are really equals as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. We are lucky in Franklin that many of our classroom support people actually do have teaching licenses. But then, yes, you know, if you're coming from being an ESP in a fifth grade and you're coming down to a K or a one, that's a different training because it's certainly not the same skills because the kids aren't at the same levels.
Right.
But yes, so we are constantly not only teaching and educating the kids, constantly monitoring, you know, are they learning what I'm teaching them now? Are they applying it? If not, what do I do for them? If yes, how do I push them? I'm constantly adjusting, or we as teachers are constantly adjusting our practice. What are we doing? Because if all my kids know the alphabet and the sounds, I don't have to spend weeks and months doing it. Mm-hmm. What's the next step? Logically, sure. How do they learn? But you are constantly assessing and changing and turning on a dime. If something's not working and they're looking at you like, what are you doing? You know enough to change.
Yeah, and then for the listeners, you can picture, certainly at a high school level, we'll go to one extreme where, you know, whether it's, and it's certainly not an alphabet at that level,
no.
But it, whatever it is, you can do a test, you can do a worksheet, and you can see the output and thereby get some credence that, okay, they know what it is. At the kindergarten level, the other end, you really have to look at their behavior because in many ways, they can't do that same kind of score sheet to get their report.
Correct.
And that observation still has to be, one, observed and then recorded in some way.
Yes. And in many ways, and I say this, for example, I have been doing this for 35 years, 25 in Franklin. I find the older kids just to be kindergartners with hormones, I guess. sometimes way more mature, sometimes not. Every age has its blessings and its challenges. And you can just see behavior is a communication. And every behavior has a message, whether it's I don't understand or I get it, move on, mm-hmm. or I need help. And every level, pre-K really through college, but higher ed, but high school, the kids are telling us something by how engaged they are, if they're engaged. And the thing is... none of these children can be separated from what goes on at home. So I always say, if your child's having a bad day at home, shoot me an email, give me a call, because I have to attend to that first. And that's the same whether they're 22, 17, 4, you know.
Or anything in between.
Yeah. You know, if they're struggling, if they're super tired, if they're not feeling well, it's good for us to know because that's just part of who they are. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what we navigate every day, all day. If you send them a lunch that they don't like, we know about it right away. And it impacts how their focus is and what they're focused on.
Right. So there's multiple ways to go within there. When a parent comes in to help in the classroom, mm-hmm. obviously the help is appreciated, but it also has to get structured in some way.
Yes.
Otherwise, it's not really a help.
Correct. So we unfortunately, and I don't know if this is true across the district, I'm guessing probably yes, is when I started in Franklin, we had five, at least at the lower level, we had approximately five volunteers in every class every day for certain things, what we call centers, which is really just a small group time. Mm-hmm. And at that time, we would have every station, I'll call it, would have a different activity going on. And so you're looking at the needs of those kids at that table. What do you want them particularly to, what do they need support in, or what do they need a challenge in, or what do they need that's just right, they just need more practice in. Mm-hmm. So you look at that for every child. You're going to group kind of like needs together. And then if you came into my classroom as a parent, obviously, we try to always have you at your table with your child. You know, and we always say the teacher is kind of still the boss. Because sometimes that's really hard. It's like when they see us out, they don't know, oh, do I listen to Mrs. Grady, even though we're in Stop and Shop? You know, you do still have to mm-hmm. as much as the kids love it, they don't quite know what to make of it the first couple times.
Right.
And so when you come in, is the activity is laid out with the objectives. It's laid out, you know, why are we doing this? What are the kids getting it? It's there's usually a sheet written up. If there's any special kind of supports you need in place for certain kids,
mm-hmm.
There's usually a model. So I've made a model. And then a lot of times as adults, we want to do things for kids because who wants to see a child struggling? But that's actually how they learn. You know, and so we talk.
Learning and failing is actually part of, failing is part of learning, not just.
Not just like, oh, this looks really pretty. And that is the hard part.
Yeah.
You know, and for me, it's, well, how much do I say without breaking confidence,
mm-hmm.
a confidentiality, but so that you and the student can be successful. It's really interesting to see because I think a lot of people, because pretty much everyone has gone to school, have a preconceived notion of what it's like to be an educator. And then they come in and after 20 minutes say, oh my gosh, I have a completely new understanding and I'm going to go home and take a nap. but we appreciate because it also shows your child and their friends that you're interested. And it gives you a new perspective so that when they come home, you know, you can say, oh, I know what you mean when you say, oh, I went to centers today or I did a math activity. What is it? Mm-hmm. It gives you a context, I guess.
Right. Yeah, because the center is kind of the table in the room around a particular activity, whether math or reading or whatever, that generally reinforces something that's already been structured in the delivery process anyway.
Correct. It reinforces its practice. For some kids, it may be a review. For others, it may be an extension. It's just kids learn better hands-on in a small group. So the concept may have been taught in a larger group.
Mm-hmm.
And now this is the time that they're practicing one of the many skills they've learned. And then when there's another adult at a table, I go to each table to make sure that each child is getting what they need.
Mm-hmm.
So at any given table, there may be one activity, but if there's five kids, they're each getting something different. They're each giving and getting something different.
Right.
And then I take all of that information and really say at night, do these two children need to be in this group or do they need to be in another group? So then it's adjusted again.
Right. So it's kind of like coming back, rejiggering, reshuffling the cards.
Correct.
To a certain extent.
And every night.
Every night. It's always a reshuffle to accommodate, to make sure you're advancing as much as possible without killing or harming or leaving somebody behind even.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, and obviously for the younger kids, you want to make it fun. Kids learn when it's fun. They're engaged. They want to have fun. They want to, you know, they want to win over their friends. And that's the whole, you know, we're teaching them how do you be a good sport. Nobody likes to lose. We mm-hmm. know that.
Right.
And you put all those social pieces in, particularly at the lower elementary late age, but really going through because they have to learn how to be good sports.
Mm-hmm. Right. So something, as I understand it, something like that still happens in the middle school level where whether at a sixth grade, seventh grade, now you've got kind of the math teacher, the social studies teacher, the language teacher together now.
Yes.
Collaborating and doing those kind of centers, but maybe around theme, maybe around a concept.
Yes. And we used to do that at the early level. We would do theme-based things because we know that everybody learns better when things are connected.
Sure.
And at the middle school, and I'm assuming at the high school level, those kids are doing small group or individual projects or partner projects because that's how they learn best.
Right.
So you accommodate for that. You have to think about who's going to be the best partner. Who's not going to be the best partner?
Mm-hmm.
You have to think about social dynamics outside the classroom. Oh, well, I know outside these two aren't getting along. Do I put them together and make them work it out? Do I let them mm-hmm. work it through? I mean, there's really a lot of nuances that go in that you don't see. Because when you come in, you may see a controlled chaos, or what you think of as a controlled chaos. But it's really very, very thoughtful, no matter what level it is. Very thoughtful and very mindful and very much planned out. It can change if it needs to, but it takes a lot of planning. It's who's in the room at the time. Is there going to be another adult? Am I going to be in there by myself? Is one group more independent than another? What can I start one group on? Well, I really have to focus on another group. Mm-hmm. Then what do I do with the other three groups? So it's a lot of juggling, but when you know your kids and have an opportunity to observe them and really watch them and interact with them, it gets easier over time. It's never easy. But when we have the support in the classroom, as I said, pre-COVID, we had a lot of parents, which was great. Mm-hmm. And we actually had a lot more ESPs. The budget doesn't allow for that anymore.
No.
Which is a shame because it makes a huge difference.
Well, and that was one of the things going back even in history. At one point in time, we had a grant because we were moving from half day to full day kindergarten. So we had a grant with an aide in each of the classrooms. And that went some number of years. And then the grant expired. And, oh, by the way, it wasn't in the budget.
Yes. We were one of the first districts in the state to go full-time in kindergarten, and we were one of the first recipients of what was then known as the kindergarten grant. Mm-hmm. So the kindergarten grant supplied all kinds of, as you said, developmentally appropriate toys, games, books, puzzles, the way we know kids learn, and eventually expanded to first grade, but it also included personnel. So I think we had, so when Keller opened, it had five classrooms of every grade level, K to five, 25 kids in a class, but at that was the year that we all had, at least in the K and one, I think we all had
an aide,
which was wonderful. Mm-hmm. And then as the grant went on and became less and less, then we would have maybe one split between two classes, and then we had one split between three classes, and then it was like we had one split between four classes, but then maybe we had a special educator. So you know, and that's great. I mean, it's such a blessing to have these folks. I work all over the state, and I go into other districts. We truly have such a talented, professional, dedicated staff. We are truly blessed, but we still need more. We need more trained bodies who love kids, who know how kids learn. Just because of the time constraints, you had talked about time before with prep time. We can literally tell you what we do from the minute we walk in to the minute we leave, because we are down to the minutes. Mm-hmm. How many minutes on learning, how many minutes not on learning, you know, how many minutes per subject, things like that. And it's we can do it when we have the help.
And quote a standard schedule, because then if life happens and so-and-so, who is supposed to provide some special ed that day, gets called out for something or doesn't show up, then all of a sudden there's this gyration of adjustments.
One person being out could literally affect four, five, six different classrooms. Mm-hmm. And what do you do? And who's going to be serviced? Who's not going to be serviced? What do you need to adjust in your own day? Well, if I adjust this, what can you adjust? And it's a major domino effect. Mm-hmm. And people will come in sick because it's easier. It's easier for the whole staff.
Right.
You know, you don't want to get anybody sick, but it's when I do my sub plans, again, I do very specific, so there's never a question. And then I'll say, if anything comes up, just do the best you can. Mm-hmm. So that there's enough to do meaningful, because you don't, we value these kids. We value their learning. We value their time. You don't give them busy work. That's a waste of time.
Right.
It's a waste of my time to put it together. It's a waste of their time to look at it.
They'll recognize it very quickly.
Oh, 100%. And 100% will call you out on it.
Oh, what do you mean? We just did this.
Yeah, we did this already. Are we doing this again? Did you forget? You know, when kids are at school, what we do, it may come back and you may go, oh great, another coloring sheet. There's actually a purpose for everything we do. Mm-hmm. And what I say when we do new teacher orientation at the beginning of the year is, if you don't know what your objective is, if you don't understand or can articulate what you want the students to get and be able to do, then you need to rethink why you're doing that activity. Mm-hmm. Because if someone comes in and asks you, you need to be able to tell them. Mm-hmm. And when they're done, what are you going to do? Are you following up with paper activity, what would be better? Is it a hands-on? Why would you pick a hands-on? You need to be able to articulate. We have end-of-year standards, and you need to know what they are and be working towards them all the time.
Right, because there is an entire curriculum level. We probably could do an entire level on that or an entire episode on the curriculum, because while generally you've got standards, obviously, from DESE, et cetera, from time to time, the standards will change.
Yes.
So you've got a new social studies curriculum, you get a new math curriculum, now you got a new literacy curriculum.
Yes.
All of those things takes adjustments, because then you go back down to your detail level and you're planning to the minute. Now you've got to swap out all the materials potentially to incorporate this new piece.
Correct. And you have to make sure they all meet the standards, or at least bring us towards the standards. And then we also typically, whatever grade level you're in, you also typically try to learn the standards of the step before and the step after, so that you know where the kids are coming from and what they've been exposed to and where they're going to. You know, I'm a big proponent. I don't say, for example, kindergarten is the getting ready for first grade year. It's a kindergarten year. They need to enjoy it. But I do, as their teacher, need to know where they're going towards. Mm-hmm. What are the skills they're going to need? And so we just kind of learn the standards, whatever they may be at that time.
Yeah, because kindergarten, in my understanding, having spent the time that I have, obviously, listening to my wife tell the stories, the key piece from the kindergarten perspective is kind of like, this is their intro to formal schooling.
Yes.
And they get into the routine, so for whatever that classroom, that school, and learning to learn, I think, is one of the key pieces.
Exactly.
In that. And when they first come in that door in September, they're totally clueless. Yay, maybe by the end of September, they've made some significant progress towards that. But then trying to do those assessments, which each take time one-on-one, if you've got 25, what are the other 24 going to do if you don't have an adult in the classroom, right?
Well, that's it, because you can't just say, talk amongst yourselves. And at the beginning of the year, really for any level kid, but any level of student, but particularly the younger ones, you have to assume they don't have what we call, quote, school behavior. Mm-hmm. So you teach them one routine at a time. A lot of times if you say, okay, come on, we're going to line up, a lot of kids don't know what that means.
Yeah, what does that mean?
What
two
does
by
it
two,
mean?
One by one,
right.
Whatever?
You know, you want me to do what, where? And so you literally, you model, you practice, you practice, you practice, you model, you go back. Then when you think they've got it, you have to do it again. And so you do a few of the basics every day, basic routines. Luckily, at the beginning, we don't need snow pants and boots and all that stuff. But, you know, what does it mean to line up? What does it look like, sound like, feel like? What does it mean when you go into your classroom? So you may start with those two for the first week, and each day you build one other thing. Okay, well, today we're going to get snack. What does that look like? Today we're going to walk through the cafeteria. What does that look like? Because if you do too much, number one, they're all crying and it's all overwhelming. But it's really no different, for example, when the fifth graders go to sixth grade, because it's such a big leap, or when the eighth graders go to ninth grade. Mm-hmm. Right. There are new routines. It's a new culture.
Right.
You know, they're all coming to us at the lower level. Many of them are coming from different towns. Many of them are coming from different preschool, play school, daycare, whatever, some nothing. So you kind of have to make it a good, loving, caring, positive relationship, and you have to make it fun. You have to have a shtick.
Mm-hmm. And so I think when you've got the entire school district, clearly, as we've talked heavily on the kindergarten, the elementary side, but there are commonalities between middle school and high school, but there are also some differences. Mm-hmm. From a bargaining perspective, even their work days technically are going to be somewhat different because of the nature of the students involved.
Correct.
The nature of the work and the delivery process involved. That's, I'm assuming, a challenge as well for you and the union too, because now they've got to coordinate amongst themselves.
It is. So what's really interesting when we hold union meetings is we used to hold them in classrooms. And it was very eye-opening. So elementary is very labor-intensive. Mm-hmm. and it's labor intensive, so that by the time they get up to the high school, it's not labor intensive.
Right. You kind of go from one spectrum to
absolutely.
The other.
So what I say is, for example, elementary teachers teach every subject all day to all kids, and then on top of it, our whole lives are a mess, mashed in social emotional, because our kids are little and that's just who they are. Mm-hmm. And then in middle school, it's they go to different teachers for different subjects generally.
Right.
They're a little bit more independent.
Mm-hmm.
Their day and their subjects are longer, because they can handle it. And then when they go to high school, they're more independent. They're less, in theory, needy.
Mm-hmm.
Where the middle schoolers tend to have bigger social emotional issues, the high school kids seem to be, at least in my perspective, less needy, but they're much more independent. They know what they're doing. They're doing their sports and whatever. So when we come to the bargaining table, we have to prepare for months before. We survey everybody. You know, we don't want to go to the table and say, okay, we think everybody's concerned about A, B, and C, and find out it's really X, Y, and Z.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to give non-leading questions on a survey. Tell us your top 10 things. Then, and we do that, we have over 400 teachers, people in Unit A,
mm-hmm.
which is teachers, and we bargain each unit separately.
Right.
So all the teachers, all the department heads, nurses, related service people, counselors, they're all in our unit. So we do an initial survey, then we take everyone's 10 answers and we collate the top five. And then we say, okay, these are the top five. Tell us your top three. And we go down from there. And then we say, okay, we have to look at what is the best for the whole.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, even when we try to do that, for an example, this past negotiations, it came up that for the elementary level, prep time hadn't been changed in years. It hadn't been increased, and we had really 2 to 3 new initiatives curriculum-wise. And even just an additional 5 minutes would be a blessing. So we decided amongst the negotiation team, which starts off very large,
mm-hmm.
and get smaller and smaller, that was going to be an issue. And then, you know, when you go to the bargaining table, that's a whole nother thing, because what does the school department see as issues? Do you have commonalities?
Mm-hmm.
But again, we go back to what are most important for everybody. Okay, well, then we might come up with, oh, well, speech and language pathologists haven't talked about any of their schedules for a while. So, you know, we start with the commonalities. So everybody knows when you go into bargaining, money is an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to start with that, or do you want to get language that really affects everybody? And when we do that, when we prepare, we always have 2 to 3 hour preparation sessions with the entire team.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have, okay, we have prep sessions for what are we going to talk about today? We go in and we have our points for the day, which we may or may not get to, depending on what school department wants to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
We come to consensus during, usually our bargaining time is 4 hours at a time. We do that. We have a lot of walkout meetings at that time, and then we debrief after.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and then through all of that, and usually it takes about 6 months, then we have to bring it back to the entire membership. So we come up with what's called an MOU. These are the things we have tentative agreements on. What do you think about that? And we may come back and they may say, no way, go back.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What we try to do is, even during all of this, is communicate with our membership to let them know it's not a state secret. We want you to know we took all of these issues. They may not affect everybody, but we took the top three, the top five. And this seems to affect the most. We may get in other little things for smaller groups if we can.
Mm-hmm.
But for example, we have contractual stipends. We have athletic stipends. We have instructional stipends. I've been in Franklin for 25 years. They may have been increased once. So even though our salaries have gone up, those have not.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been no cost of living increase for those?
On the stipend
level. On the stipend level.
So let's go back to the salary piece, because I think that's one of the pieces that I, at least from my perspective, knowing some of the inside story, if you will, hasn't been well told before, to the extent that for some number of years you had what they called steps and lanes.
Yep.
So a lane, as I understood it, was kind of like the entry level. You started with a bachelor's degree, then you would go to a master's or some number of periods in the master's and up to a doctorate potentially. Some of those lanes got changed over time, and some of the steps, which effectively would be incremented by year, got consolidated over time.
Correct. Yes. So I've actually had the pleasure of looking through the last 20 contracts. So when I came to Franklin, there were lanes are exactly what you said. So it started with bachelor's. Then it was like bachelor's plus, I think, 15 college credits. Bachelor's plus 30 college credits, then master's. So we condensed a lot of that. So there would be a conformity. Years and years ago, when you became a teacher, the only degree you could get was master's in the field. Up until about, I think last year or the year before, we still had one person in the district who was master's in the field. So we had to keep that lane. Until somebody, until there's nobody left in a certain lane, we have to keep it. So we condensed those lanes. I'm going to say, I'm going to give a guess. I'm going to say we had possibly 10 lanes. We condensed those down to about seven, if not less. And then each lane may have had 15 steps.
Right.
We've also condensed those down so that one lane, I believe it's the bachelor's, when you come in, until you get your master's degree, you're stuck on a step six until you go to the next degree level.
Okay, so it's not just a straight going down. You also have to make some
progress. You have to make
progress
something to go across.
In order to go down further.
Correct.
Which, from a certification, educational preparation, even at a master level, master's not the right word because master is also a degree.
Yes.
But at that efficiency level, it makes sense to kind of move down and over at the same time.
Yes.
And as a enforcement mechanism almost, in order to, once you reach that point, if you haven't moved over, well then...
You're stuck at that point.
Until you move over.
Correct.
Right.
So it's, on the one hand, it's a really good thing because you constantly have to keep your certification or certifications up.
Which is, I think, every 5 years?
Every 5 years. That doesn't always equate to a degree, although because everything's so expensive, oftentimes it will.
Right.
And so, yes, so every year that you work a certain number of days and your performance is proficient or exemplary, at the end of that year for the next year, you go up a step. So if I'm on step five in 2024, I'm going to go up to step six. But then I'm stuck at step six until, if I'm on a bachelor's degree, until I then go up to a master's degree. Well, master's degree, when I got my master's degree, it was under $12,000. I think master's degrees now are a little bit more than $12,000. So I have plenty of credits now, but I have my master's degree. Probably I must be at least 45 or 60 credits, but I couldn't afford to do another master's program. So I'm stuck at the master's level that I'm stuck at.
Right.
Until if I decide to go and consolidate those in a program or go to a doctorate, which I am not prepared to do.
Yeah. No, because having been to my own master's program in a corporate world, that in itself was enough of a challenge trying to work that into an environment, but never mind in respectfully, there's still similarities, but I know even for my wife's perspective, she was in some cases putting in more hours than I was in the corporate environment and working my extra time, et cetera. So that, and never mind life cycle in terms of family and other family needs, et cetera. So there's a lot to that.
Yes, we have to have, according to the Department of Ed, we have to have, and it, I think it just changed again, we used to have 120 essentially credits, I'll say, PDPs, CEUs, a lot of people know them as, to to continue our certification.
CEUs, continuing ed units.
Continuing ed units, yes. Right. And PDPs are professional development points.
Right.
And they do all kinds of conversions, which I teach kindergarten math for a reason. but so you keep it up over the 5 years, but for a long time, for example, if I needed a science course, the Department of Ed may have only offered a science course every 4 years. Yeah. So if I missed it, I was out of luck.
Right.
The district is required, every district is required to provide professional development opportunities.
Correct.
They're becoming harder to come by. And then for a long time, you know, we didn't have anything online when I started. And then it was, is this rigorous enough? Is this really what you're looking for?
Mm-hmm. Is it worth your while?
Is it worth your while? You know, some credits, some places, if you go online, DESE will accept the credits. Some places they won't.
Mm-hmm.
So then you go through the list. So, I mean, it's not, I will never say it's not worthwhile to continue your education. My parents still joke with me, if I could be a professional student, I would, and I would.
Mm-hmm.
It would probably be cheaper, maybe, but we do. We always are keeping up, and these are things that we do also on our professional development days. We are constantly developing curriculum. We're constantly kind of honing our own skills, always. We're reviewing or updating curriculum we have.
Mm-hmm.
We're researching curriculum. A lot of us... my big thing has always been health and safety and how children learn,
mm-hmm.
health and safety of children and staff. And so I am always doing research on play and how children learn. Does it really change over time? So far, no. But we know their skills are different.
Mm-hmm.
Really, since COVID, we've seen it. And so what is the impact on, you know, their classroom lives, for lack mm-hmm. of a better word?
Yeah, because COVID, clearly, while everybody went through it, the kids have come through it, but in many ways, I think we're seeing and starting to see, perhaps, some of the detriments that have been there, where conceptually the kids, by missing that interaction because they were remote, trying to do stuff, etc.,
exactly.
they're still trying to catch up, and thereby you're having to, and you meaning the entire district teaching's environment, is trying to help each of them catch up in that area or this area in order to get to where they need to be in that point in time. But consider, you know, what, however many students we have across the district, that's hard.
It is hard on a good day. If I have 21 students, I have 21 different learning styles or combination of learning styles, and if two children have the exact same birthday and the exact same time, which doesn't often happen, they're still, even though the sequence of how they learn is the same, the pace, it could be like night and day.
Individual, absolutely.
Totally individual. So you really are taking the curriculum or whatever you have and making it individualized for each student.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you may come in and say, oh, but I see the same paper on everyone's or the same activity on everyone's table. You may, but what each student is expected to do or take from it is could be completely different.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we need more people. You know, I joke to the kids, yep, I'm a mom and I've been a teacher for a long time, so I have eyes everywhere, but I really only have the two in the front.
Yeah, the mirage is there, but it's not as effective as it needs to be.
And then you throw on the bargaining. So I felt for the 2 years before COVID and then after, all we did is bargain because we had to have memorandums because the situations changed almost every other month.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody had to deal with that. So we will be going into, I feel like we just finished the non-teacher units and I almost died. I think Jamie or Lucas had said the other day, town administrator or superintendent said, almost all of the town unions and the teachers are going back into bargaining again. It's like, oh my goodness, we just finished that. But we're always preparing. So my team has, I've already asked people who are interested, who are knowledgeable, but you also want to bring new people on.
Mm-hmm. Fresh blood, fresh eyes.
Fresh blood, because I'm not doing this for a super long time anymore.
Mm-hmm. Succession planning happens on your side.
Succession planning happens, and you have to pass on the institutional knowledge
mm-hmm.
and the papers that go with the institutional knowledge. So there's a constant stream of knowledge sharing. and answering questions and also mentoring new people who come into the profession, which unfortunately right now isn't a lot.
Right.
The teacher programs are not full. Nobody's knocking down the doors to get in them.
Yeah, and that's a separate demographic issue.
Yes.
To the extent that the entire population, particularly going into the colleges, if you haven't heard, there are a number of colleges that in the next 5 years may not be there anymore because there's not enough population to sustain them.
Yeah.
So that's a whole other piece. Not in our scope.
No.
We have our own population decline potentially and then still coming back, but we're going to be right about where we are after 10 years from what I've seen for the numbers so far.
Yes, it may even be a little less. And it's that is very, very typical is we look at the numbers and we say, oh, my goodness, they're going to really, really decline. But when you look at them, it's really not because every student coming in comes in with their own gifts, comes in with their own challenges. And what we're finding is many of the kids are coming in with some kind of trauma, particularly since COVID. And the world is very different. It's a harsh place to be. And there's not a lot of coping skills that we used to get growing up, and that's really difficult because you can't be available to learn when you don't have these other skills.
Right.
And so we're having to do that first, you know, to partner with communities and families, which it should be to do that because the educators say you talked about acronyms, but you can't Maslow before you Bloom. And so you have to get all those basic needs. Are kids being fed? Are kids being clothed? Do they have a safe home life? Do they have a safe home? Do they have a steady home? What is their food insecurity? All of those things come into play every day.
Yes.
Never thought you would say it in Franklin, but it's in Franklin. It's everywhere.
I just recorded with the Empty Bowls leadership team. So, it's there. The food pantry is busier than ever.
Yep.
Because it's there. It's what it is.
Yep.
I mean, we have to deal with it. And that's if one message I would say to, especially as we get into this budget cycle, however we got here, we can't change.
Right. This is where we are.
This is where we are. The one thing we need to do is have a civil discourse to figure out our future.
And I had read somewhere, this came so fast. I've been in Franklin for 25 years, and I've been hearing it for 25 years. It really didn't. I think Franklin's growth happened really fast, and then it slowed down, and then it was happening again.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree, Steve. There needs to be a congenial social conversation because everybody's perspective is different.
Right.
But the reality is this is one town. I mean, we're almost big enough to be a city, but we're still a town. We still have a small town mentality.
Legally, we are a city.
Okay, legally we are.
We call ourselves a town. That's part of the charter. The town of Franklin is defined, and Jamie and even Jeff Nutting before would say, we're the only city with a town clerk. And it was true, because we have that city form of government.
Right, but we still have a small town feel, which
is even when I started, people would say, "Well, what's Franklin like?" In many ways, like a middle schooler. Some days we were very adultish, wanting to move on and get away. And some days we were not very adultish and didn't want to go and do anything.
Exactly.
And that's exactly what a middle schooler was.
100%. And that's, you know, I have a colleague, and I'm totally going to steal her line, is whenever we would talk and negotiate or do whatever, she would say, we can disagree 100%, but it doesn't mean we have to be disagreeable.
True.
And, you know, I guess what's coming out of all of these past elections and even now with the budget discussion is at least people are talking. What I would encourage people to do is actually also listen.
Yes.
You know, because when you're thinking of the next thing you want to say in response, you're not listening, and we all have valuable opinions.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean we have to agree. It doesn't mean we have to hate each other. I think that's what worries me now is if somebody doesn't agree, that means I have to hate them. That's not it.
No.
You know, I don't live in Franklin, but you all live in Franklin, and we all work here. I consider Franklin my second home. Many of you know I'm here all the time,
mm-hmm.
is having those discussions can be really productive and really move the schools and the town and the other services where they need to be, because this budget issue is going to end up being a quality of life issue, not only for the people who are here now, but the kids who may come here later as adults or teenagers, or the kids who are here now who are going to grow up in this town, mm-hmm. is, you know, what are we going to leave for them, and what are we going to make the foundation in Franklin for them? And I think when we put them first and talk about them and what do we value for them, then the conversation goes more positively, I
right.
guess.
Right.
Because it really is for them. And they're going to be the ones taking care of the rest of us.
Yeah, and I think that's where the, at least credit to the department and to the school committee with the portrait of the graduate, mm-hmm. the vision and how do, what's the skills and capabilities coming out when they yes. graduate? Those are the skills and capabilities, at least for today and for the next
yep.
period of time. Corporate world, real world will need that.
Yes.
And then backing into that, and I believe, at least based on what I've seen in the school committee meetings, each of the schools is trying to do their programs tying to aspects, developmentally appropriate where possible, to that portrait of graduate. Because it really starts in the pre-K going right through 12.
It does. And, you know, I worry when people say, my child's experience in this school is different than your child's in this school. One of the things that we're so blessed with, as I said before, and I will always say it, is the highly talented professional staff that we have here in the mm-hmm. schools. We were hired for our expertise. We were hired for what we know about kids, no matter what their age. And so if you let us show our expertise with the kids, you know, we can have the same curriculum. But we're all different people, and we bring different things to the table. And when we make our class list moving on, for example, we take so many hours to make sure that kids are paired up with a friend, but also with a style of teaching that's going to benefit them, again, whether they're 4 or 18. And we really do take pride in, and these kids are our kids, too. They're with us an awful lot, and, mm-hmm. and we really do think of them that way. And, you know, we hurt when they hurt, and we are happy when they're happy, and we do want what's best for them because they are our kids, too. And there's so much thought that goes into everything. And one of my most favorite things in all my 35 years doing is to be able to sit back and watch the kids mm-hmm. and really get a sense of them. I mean, we are people readers. And unfortunately, I haven't been able to do that very much in the last many years because we just don't have the people to allow that. Yeah. And the best way that I can get to know the kids is to watch them, or even better, be able to interact with them. You know, I don't stand up in front of them. That's not what you do anymore. You know, I don't stand up in front of, I may stand up for the beginning of a lesson, but then my responsibility is to go around and really touch base with each child many, many times throughout the day to make sure that they are okay mm-hmm. and that they know that I care about them. Kids learn from people that they know care about them.
Yes.
That doesn't mean it's you know, they're never going to hear no, because they are.
Right.
But it's
that's
just
part of the learning process.
That's part of the learning process. And if they know that as a community, we all care about them, mm-hmm. think about how we all grew up. If I did something wrong, my neighbor knew it and my mother knew it. And, you know, that really is, I would love to see. Are we going to go back to that time? We're not. But, you know, when a child knows that you really care about them and that you have their heart in your heart, they're going to learn from mm-hmm. you and they're going to be happy, and they are happy. That's a message I need to get out there is kids are going to struggle, and there's different struggles now than when we went to school, but they are really happy. Do they love everything they do? Nope, but I don't love everything I do all the time. And we have to remember that. There's a difference between, you know, not being content and engaged and happy at school and just not liking everything.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But the kids are happy. I travel the state in kind of my president's job, and I'm involved with the board of directors for Mass Teachers. And kids are genuinely happy and they're engaged. And, you know, there's different challenges now, but they are happy. And I think that's the most important thing.
Thank you for taking time to explain a bunch of things in this, you know, certainly Franklin education classroom experience across elementary, middle, and high school. After we covered everything, it'll take many more sessions to cover much more of that. But hopefully the listeners will appreciate that. I certainly do. So,
thank you. My pleasure. Thank you for asking the questions.
Absolutely. And a quick reminder for the listeners, we do this because Franklin matters.
We are now producing this in collaboration with Franklin TV and Franklin Public Radio. This podcast is my public service effort for Franklin, but we can't do it alone. We can always use your help. How can you help? If you can use the information that you find here, please tell your friends and neighbors. If you don't like something here, please let me know. Through this feedback loop, we can continue to make improvements. And I thank you for listening. For additional information, please visit franklinmatters.org. If you have questions or comments, you can reach me directly at suresteve@gmail.com. The music for the intro and exit was provided by Michael Clark and the group East of Shirley. The piece is titled Ernesto Mañana, copyright Michael Clark and Tintype Tunes in 2008, and used with their permission. I hope you enjoy. By the way, you can also subscribe and listen to Franklin Matters Radio on your favorite podcast app. Search in podcasts for Franklin Matters.